Hi, I'm Charlie. I've been in Al-Anon for 18 years, I think. So I took a lot of notes because otherwise I'll forget. And so here I am. I'm an adult child. I am going to talk about my tragic childhood, my experiences, strength, and hope. So, wow, that seems really loud. Is this how we doing? Good? Okay. So I grew up in a dysfunctional household. My parents were alcoholics, although I didn't know it at the time. They had one or two martinis every night, sometimes more. I thought that was normal. And my mom was a school teacher. She'd get home from school and she'd start drinking before my dad even got home. And she was, the hard part with her was she was like this teapot when she would get mad about something. And she'd kind of simmer and then start banging doors and slamming things. And you never really knew what was wrong. She'd just be glaring at you. And so ultimately, she'd blow up either at us or my dad. She'd go to bed. Wake up the next day as if nothing happened and no one would ever talk about it. It was very weird. And then my sister and I, like as adult children, we've got our antennas up for, whatever's going on. Is somebody mad? Is somebody anxious? And we just did what we could to stay out of her way. My teen years, I hated being home. And I would leave whenever I could. I stayed out as much as I could. And it was just this lonely time. I didn't want to be around the house, particularly when my parents were fighting. I started drinking at 15, starting with beer. Then it migrated to cheap wine, then marijuana, variety of psychedelic drugs, whatever I could do, to, in retrospect, kind of kill the pain of life. Never used a needle, but I watched people do it. I had limits. And even with all the drugs and the alcohol and the partying, it was a really lonely time. So my parents would have lots of parties, pool parties, bridge parties, the card game bridge, dinner parties, and the alcohol would just flow at those things. Well, this was suburbia back in the 60s. It was the neighborhood I lived in. Everybody's parents did the same thing. We're, I guess, the first generation of latchkey kids. Our parents were gone most of the day working. My dad and my mom was a school teacher. And then they'd go out in the evenings having fun. And kids left alone, to fend for themselves while we get in trouble. Who knew? I remember even coming home from high school a few times. Like, I can't even drive yet. And there's $20 and a note on the bar saying, we went to Mexico for the weekend. And it's like, okay, call my friends up, party. What were they thinking? I just, and I think that's the issue. They weren't thinking about anything but themselves. They didn't know how to deal with us on an emotional level. I think that was the bottom line. They had a lot of character defects, and most of which I wouldn't find out about until later when I was going through recovery. Had a brother and a sister. My brother was 10 years older than me. When he was 22, he got a 16-year-old girl pregnant and married her because that's what you did back then. My sister was 4 years older than me, straight A student, went to UC Berkeley right out of high school. 6 months later, she crashed and burned, came home with a hippie, moved out. My mom is just like climbing the walls, screaming. And, I think with my sister, they were just way too overprotective of her. And so she didn't know what to expect out in the real world. So the three kids, two down, one to go. I'm their last hope for a successful child. That made them so they pretty much let me do whatever I wanted. And I don't know how that fit together. But they didn't have good parenting skills. They didn't have good boundaries. I would come home drunk, banging into doors, and my dad would just come home and kind of laugh, and I'd go to bed. Nobody ever said anything about it. And, it was my sister when she moved out that told me that our parents were alcoholics. And I didn't believe her at the time. They just have a couple of martinis every night. Alcoholics are the bums you see in the street, right? So I'm my last hope for a successful child. And I ultimately became their trophy child. I'd been taking this electronics class in junior college. And one day I'm leaving on a Friday afternoon, and the counseling office is closed, but I thought I would drop by anyway. And this is one of those pivotal moments in my life where I know my higher power was looking out for me. But there's a counselor there, and I described what I wanted to do. And he says, "Oh, you want to be an engineer?" And I thought, "Oh, okay." So I applied to Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo. I got in, and I got an electrical engineering degree. It's kind of amazing. So I'm the lucky child, right? What I wanted for me is the same thing that my parents wanted for me. So, let's see. And I think it was my desire to get away from my parents that really drove me to go to college and get away. It was a way out. So here I am, college. I'm 21, finally out of my parents' house. Still felt lonely, very uncomfortable myself, not even sure who I was. I lacked a lot of confidence in social settings, especially around women. I was a bit of a geek, which you would expect of an engineer. I tried reading books like I'm Okay, You're Okay, to figure out who I am. Some of you remember that. And it was popular at the time, and it helped a little, but I really struggled with emotional intimacy and instead looking for physical intimacy to fill that void. And did that work? No. It helped. But going to college and taking a heavy workload was a real lifesaver for me, as I didn't have time for alcohol and drugs. I don't know how anybody could go to college and do that. Maybe a couple of beers on the weekend, but I was driven. I took 17, 18 units a quarter, which is what you did as an engineering student. It was the only way to get through. And so I graduated, actually graduated with honors. Amazing, considering I almost didn't graduate from high school. So there's a lot to be said for being obsessive compulsive. It was one of the survival skills I learned. And while I was in college, I went home every few weeks. I'd drive up Friday night, visit my girlfriend more than my parents. And generally, it was okay hanging out with my parents for that short amount of time. And they got the benefit of showing me off as their trophy child. And they'd even introduce me that way. Here's our son, the engineer. And I thought it was pretty cool at the time. But over time, I came to hate it, because what I realized is they're not me they were proud of. They're proud of the success. So I'm like the trophy wife, right? Not appreciated for who she is, but rather how she looks. No fun. And I remember one time when they were having a party, and I was talking to my mom on the phone, and she's saying, "Oh, are you coming home from school this weekend?" And I said no, and we started getting into this argument. And well, what are we going to tell our friends when you're not here? And it got heated, and I finally just said, "Just tell them I'm an asshole." I don't know what to say. I'm not coming home, because I didn't want to go home just to get shown off. Anyway, and I remember another time when I came home on Friday night, and my mom had been drinking, and she started telling me all this personal stuff about my dad. And she was really pissed at him, and she was really pissed that I was trying not to listen and trying not to engage, but it turned into this huge argument. I still remember it. I left in tears and drove back home to school that night. So anyway, the rest of my visits home were less eventful. My girlfriend and I slowly drifted apart. She went off to college. I went off to college. It was actually the for the best, and I knew that because we kind of got together at a time. Well, she actually came over to my house to buy drugs one time. That's how I got to know her. And over time, and I knew it was a temporary relationship, right? So we both got cleaned up, both straightened ourselves out, and we went off to college. And I still occasionally talk to her now. She's a wonderful woman. We got four kids. So I started my first job a couple weeks. Let's see, 2 weeks after graduating, June 1976, moved straight from college to an apartment in Santa Clara. And it's like, hey, I fulfilled this goal. I'm never moving back home again. Yay. So this next section is kind of continuing my journey to Al-Anon. It covers like 28 years of what happened in the interim before I got to the doors of Al-Anon. I did life. You make plans, life happens, a lot of good things happen, a lot of bad things happened. A lot of things didn't change. I had a successful career. Being an adult child has its plus sides. I'm a people pleaser, right? We're hard workers. I knew how to get things done. I knew how to read a room with those antennas. I was a good manager. I knew how to take care of people, right? I was independent. I didn't need help from anybody. And I was a survivor. And another intervention of a higher power, I was working for a defense contractor, and that requires security clearances. So you cannot take drugs or do illegal stuff. And you didn't dare lie about it because you had to take a polygraph test every 5 years. So if it wasn't for that, I probably would have succumbed to my addictive tendencies. Because just because I'm in this room as ACA and Al-Anon, I grew up in a household where you have people with addictive tendencies and codependent tendencies. And why am I here today instead of an addict? I think that was another intervention of my higher power. I'm here for a reason. And if you remember, I mentioned earlier, I was really into drugs and alcohol for a while, about 2.5 years. It's really just to kill the hurt, the pain of life, as I call it, because at its core, that's what drugs and alcohol are all about. They're anesthetics. So there's a downside to these ACA skills, too. Some of those characteristics can be double-edged swords. I'm a people pleaser, but it makes you easy to manipulate. I can sense anyone's anxiety in the room. And that is a tendency to make you reactive. I was independent, didn't need help from anybody. And boy, is that lonely. And then there's just the bad things that I call associated with being an ACA adult child. I mentioned some of them. I was really hard on myself. I would beat myself up every time I would make a mistake. And no one needed to give me a bad time. I was my worst critic. And I always thought this was because I was a Virgo, we're critical, but later in life, it's the alcoholic upbringing. I had a hard time trusting people. I hated having to get together with my parents or in-laws during holidays. I would dread the event for days, sometimes in advance, and I'd go downhill, and then you kind of get through it, and then it would take me 3 days to recover. And a hard time saying no. That's a tough one. When I did say no, I felt bad about it. And when I had feelings, I struggled with understanding what they even were. I struggled with my addictive tendencies. I struggle today with my addictive tendencies. And a lot of the feelings I started to notice and reactions were really too strong for the situation. I wasn't living in the moment. And I was living kind of in the past, but I didn't know it at the time. And I'll say that again. This, to me, this was the core of most of my issues that ultimately drove me to Al-Anon, is that the feelings and reactions were out of place, way too strong, inappropriate. So I'd like to talk about therapy a little bit. I know it's not an Al-Anon thing, but it was part of my journey to Al-Anon. And if it wasn't for my therapy, I don't think I'd be in this room. I would not have gone to Al-Anon, and if I did, I would not have stuck with it. I learned a lot about myself in therapy. It didn't fix a lot of the alcohol related defects, but I hesitate to say this, but I went into therapy after my first wife died of cancer. She was 27. I was 30. Let's let that sink in a minute because I can keep going and leave people in the past, kind of wrap your head around that. But I only tell you that because it was a real turning point in my life. This experience that one of the experiences that made me who I am today, and it was really a bottom of the barrel event for me. One that said, you know, this isn't working. I cannot go on like this. But I did learn a lot of things about myself. I learned what I was feeling, which sounds kind of odd, but I always knew what other people were feeling. And I would get agitated and feel, but I couldn't put my finger on what it was or why. And initially, I just started figuring out, well, am I happy, sad, mad, or scared? That's a start. And over time, I learned to identify my feelings, particularly anger. And anger is an interesting one because it's a secondary emotion. You know, you go to anger and get defensive, but there's really underneath it is hurt, fear, injustice, frustration, maybe disappointment. And with time, I found that I would skip the anger part when something happened, and I would go straight to just being disappointed or getting to that. And I thought it was kind of strange at first. It's like, why am I not getting angry? Is something wrong with me? And the answer was no, I was actually getting healthy and I was getting to the feelings quicker. I was really scared of what people would think of me. That was a tough one. I was always looking for it to others for validation. Today, I know it was really love and acceptance that I was looking for. I also learned that you have to be anxious about something. For a lot of times, I would just get anxious. I'm just anxious. Well, what are you anxious about? I don't know. Do you have to be anxious about something? Well, yes, you do. And so I learned to kind of write it down. And even though I have this long list, you know, if I could address the top two, that would take care of it. The rest of it was down in the noise. And I learned to figure out if I was feeling someone else's anxiety. I do struggle with that a little bit today, but I can tell when someone in the room is anxious. I can't always tell who, but I feel that. I learned to trust my intuition completely. And to me, that's how I communicate with my higher power. When I have intuition about something, I know that's my God talking to me. Your body knows, you know, you feel it. It's like when your hair stands up on the back of your head and you know, oh gosh, something's not right here. There's danger. So I listen to my body. I listen to my gut when it tells me something isn't right. And that's one of the reasons I don't drink, even when I go to parties and stuff, because I want to feel what's going on around me. I want to be in tune to that. And I don't want to anesthetize that. So that said, there were a lot of things that weren't resolved through my therapy. Visiting dysfunctional relatives was still a nightmare. My wife and I are both adult children, so we have a lot of dysfunctional people in our lives. The family get-togethers could be horrible events. And I realized I didn't know what I wanted in a lot of situations. I knew what other people wanted, but I didn't really know what I wanted. You know, what were my traditions? And I also realized that I didn't know what I didn't know. How can you fix what you don't know? So Late 2005, I arrived at the doors of Al-Anon. Friend of ours had been going to Al-Anon, invited me to go into a meeting. I went, she didn't show up. That was okay. And it was scary, you know. It's like, well, who are these people? And why were they here? And are they going to accept me? And what do we have in common? And it was interesting listening to people talk because I kept telling myself, oh, that's me. That's me. That's me. It was amazing. And at the end, someone actually, and I told my 3-minute version of my life, but at the end, somebody came up to me and said, keep coming back. We want to hear your story. And I was shocked. Someone cared what I had to say. And so I did keep going back. And again, I think that was another intervention of a higher power, because if someone hadn't have said that, I probably would never gone back. And I knew because of the therapy I'd been through that walking through the door the second time, which for me was the scariest, I was going to be committing to some years of self-discovery, finding out more things about myself that I didn't like and that I needed to change. Finding out once again, crap, goes back to my parents. I just like to smack them. And, you know, I was a little worried that as I tried to climb over this mountain of dysfunctional behavior in front of me, that I wouldn't like who I was when I got to the other side. You know, am I going to like myself when I get there? But I do. So anyway, when I started Al-Anon, I'd already found my faith in my higher power. So steps 1 through 3 were kind of a breeze. I knew that I was powerless over my alcoholic behavior, powerless over the alcoholics and codependents in my life, and those parts of my life that were still unmanageable. I already knew my higher power could help resolve these issues, and had already made the decision to turn my life over to the will of my higher power. Steps 4 through 7 were where most of the hard work was done. Made the fearless and moral, fearless, searching and fearless moral inventory. By going to, you know, different meetings, step meetings, book studies, adult child meetings, which were hard, I discovered my character defects. Not all of them, because I still discover them today. But those adult child meetings were the toughest. I still can't read through that book today. I can read part of it and then I just have to set it down because it's just too hard. Steps 5 and 6 meant acknowledging my defects to God and another human being, being ready to have God remove my defects of character. But in addition to that, just understanding it, I had to understand the benefit I was getting out of it. Why was I continuing to do this? Why did I hang on to it for so long? And was I really ready to give it up? Some of those character defects had been survival tools. And could I just really give them up? Or could I find some other way to replace them? Step 7, asking God to remove my defects of character. But for me, that's also asking him what he wants me to learn from it and what he wants me to do with that information. Let's see. Lost something here. Okay. So anyway, so here's a few examples of my recovery. I used to motivate myself by beating myself up, being my own worst critic. Sure, it motivated me, but it was hurtful and was there a better way? Yeah, I could give myself a pat on the back for a job well done. Sounds simple, not as simple as just deciding to do it. I had to recognize it when I did it. I had to decide that I was a good person, a hard worker, and worthy of a pat on the back rather than a kick in the butt when I made mistakes. I had to remember to keep doing it. I had to work on it till it came naturally, and eventually it got easy. And I found I could use that same behavior to motivate other people, made me a better manager. It made me not afraid to make mistakes as long as I learned from it. Another example is developing appropriate boundaries. Now, that's a huge one. I could give a whole talk on boundaries. And as a matter of fact, I did back in 2015 at a District 16 Fall Fest. I gave a talk on boundaries. And my takeaway is, boundaries can be physical, like sexual intimacy, touching, just maintaining space. They can be emotional, as in not letting others abuse you emotionally. And that can be really insidious. And that's the hard one for ACAs, because you can't point to an event that happened. It isn't something that happened to me. It's just all this stuff. They can be spiritual, as in, hey, this is my God. Please respect that. Or I call temporal, giving yourself time to think about something and make a decision. Boundaries protect us. They define where we end and someone else starts. So after years, literally, of working on boundaries, I came up with this list of things I learned. It's okay to give myself time and space to see how I feel about things, to make decisions, to play out scenarios, to set boundaries, and to adjust boundaries I already have in place. And time and space are kind of my best tool. Time to think and physical space to remove myself from the situation. I don't need to answer the phone right away or reply to a text message or reply even at all. The same goes for a live person. I can just say, let me think about that. And I learned that it's okay to say no. And I practice nice ways of saying no. I have a prior commitment. I'm going to be out of town. Well, Discovery Bay is out of town. No, nobody needs to know, right? Why do I have to give people enough information to challenge me? So I use those a lot. Yeah, I'm going to be out of town. I try not to, and I practice detachment. That's a great one. I try not to take things personally. And that can be hard, particularly when someone is angry with me, because it's so easy to get defensive. And now I just try to listen, acknowledge that they're angry with me, and then try to figure out if I have some part of that. And if I do, I'll own it. If I don't, then I don't. I learned that my personal limits do not dictate a code of behavior for others. They just say what I'll do in a given situation. I also learned to limit my interactions with difficult people, especially dysfunctional people. Some people are just hard to hang out with, and so family members, let's just go out to dinner somewhere. That way you don't have to hang out with them. And so you can limit the time you're with them. And in theory, they're on better behavior because they're out in public. I also learned how to get out of bad situations when all else fails. I have some plan Bs, and I learned those first from some women who used to keep suitcases in their trunk with clothes and money. But for me, it was more like, well, maybe I can take separate cars to this thing that my wife wants to go to, and I can leave. I can get up and go to the bathroom and take out my wallet and read my detachment brochure, try to get my head together. Last resort, and one that I've used, I just take my phone out of my pocket and go, oh, I got a crisis. I got to deal with this. Walk out of the room. And that crisis is me, right? But I get myself out of that situation. I don't have to stay there. So there's another one that revolves around these inappropriate feelings, and I don't mean just an overreaction. I mean it doesn't fit at all. So for the longest time, I used to have a really tough time watching a movie or TV where someone had an affair, and I'd feel the betrayal, it would come up so strongly that I'd have to turn the TV off. I've walked out in theaters a couple occasions, and I tell my wife, I'll be back. I can't watch this. And I'd leave. And sometimes we just both leave. And I thought that was really odd because that had never happened to me. Where did that come from? I'd never been betrayed in that way. And so one day I'm watching TV. It's about this woman in Cuba and her boyfriend, and she's like a fair-skinned Cuban woman that sometimes to make money, they go to the businessman hotels and hang out and their companions for the businessmen, whatever that means. And the guy finds out because he's a cook there, and it just turns into this huge scene. And then, there's this whole betrayal thing, and I couldn't watch it. I had to turn it off, because I can feel the guy's hurt. And then I thought, well, you know what I heard recently in Al-Anon was just to ask God to take these feelings away. And so I turned it back on. I'm sitting there watching it, feeling this kick in the gut. I'm thinking, oh God, please take this away from me. And I heard this voice in my head, and it said, it's not you, it's your mom. And I opened my eyes, it was like, oh my God, that's right. My dad had an affair, and my mom was devastated, but that didn't happen to me. And in that moment, those feelings went away. It was incredible. And I remember sitting there thinking, did they really go away? And so I watched the rest of the show, and they had just been lifted away. It was so amazing. Anyway, and even to this day, those overwhelming feelings don't happen. Sure, in the moment, I can feel compassion. I can feel, oh, gee, that's really sad. But then the moment passes and it's gone. So, going to Al-Anon meetings, I've had a lot of other feelings that were too strong for the situation. But over time, I was able to realize where they came from, and every one of them went back to my childhood, some situation. And for a long time, it really pissed me off because I think, oh my God, new character defect. When is this going to end? So now I just think, okay, another character defect. Now that I can recognize it, I can work on it and let it go. Moving on, steps 8 and 9, making a list of persons we'd harmed and making amends. I'm just touch on that lightly, but yeah, the recognition and acknowledgement of fault and clearing the air. It's really nice to clear that air. And when I was doing that, I found that a lot of times the other person had completely forgot about it or forgiven me or both. But yet I was harboring this. Oh my gosh, there's this elephant in the room. Well, the elephant had long gone. So it was clearing the air for me. In the last three steps, continuing to take personal inventory, including going back to that 4 through 7 cycle, I'll be sitting in the meeting and go, oh yeah, there's another one. Still happens. I've been at it 18 years, but it still happens. I try to continue my. Improve my conscious contact for God, praying for His will for me and the power to carry the message to others. And one of my prayers is that when I'm in the middle of an issue, I'm in the middle of an issue, it's like, God, help me through this and help me understand what it is you want me to learn from it and how you want me to carry that to the next person. Well, what do you want me to do with this information now that I have it? A lot of times it's way later. You have to be out of that situation. You look back and go, oh, yeah. And that carrying the message happens a lot in meetings. You listen and somebody will say something and you'll have a chat with them afterwards, or you'll try to tailor your whatever you're going to say to be talking to them without really talking to them. And I just try to keep in mind that, when it's time for that to happen, my higher power is going to put that person in front of me. I don't have to go looking for them. God's going to put them there. God's going to tell me what to do and what to say. So here I am, Charlie Teal, in service to Al-Anon. I shouldn't have said my last name, but I don't care. How do I give back? I go to meetings. I'm the website coordinator for District 14. I've been group rep, literature person, secretary for Discovery Bay Al-Anon. I provide technical support. My background helps out. I purchased the equipment and worked with Brandon. We set up this electronic thing that you're looking at now. I don't know if you want to take a look back there when you go, but it's daunting. First time I looked at it, I thought, oh my God, how do I do this? And actually, my son helped me. My son works for Intel, and I called him up and said, here's what I want to do. And he goes, oh yeah, I know how to do that. Easier said than done, but it worked. So I do that. I do technical studies. I help set up the hybrid business meeting. And I tell my story when I can. And I listen for how, what God wants me to do with all of this crap I've learned over my lifetime. And, you know, I do continue to go to Al-Anon meetings every week because it's part of what fills my gas tank. You know, a lot of things in life are draining, and some things fill you up, and you have to recognize both of those. So I just keep going to keep my gas tank filled. So, and by giving back, you also receive. There's that reward you get when you help someone that I struggled with for a while because I thought I'm getting too much out of this, you know, and I'm trying to help this other person. So how does that work? But it's okay. And one last thought, you know, although I wouldn't wish my life experiences on anybody, they made me who I am, and I like who I am today. So, thank you. Okay.